Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Ted Aub. Aub is a sculptor and professor of art at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York. His professional life outside of teaching has included exhibits of his bronze cast sculpture in galleries and museums nationally, as well as public commissions both here and abroad. Aub has been described as a postmodern surrealist for his independent work, and much of his public work is of historic figures and is rendered in traditional ways. His most prominent regional commission, When Anthony Met Stanton, depicts the first meeting of suffragettes Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and can be seen in Seneca Falls, New York. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Now, your biography suggests that you began your art career by studying painting. Now, is that a traditional way for a sculptor to start his career?
No, probably not. I think a lot of sculptors begin by sculpting. Actually, I began early on with cartooning.
Really?
And I thought maybe that's the path that I would follow. I was interested in political cartooning, and I did some of that in high school and in college. But I was majoring in painting at Washington University in St. Louis. And one thing that painters did as an elective commonly was to take sculpture courses. And these were figure sculpture courses, which had nothing to do with what the sculptors were doing. And that's what led me from painting to figure sculpture.
And what kind of painting were you doing? Were you just not interested in it, or you just fell in love with sculpture?
Well, I like painting, but interestingly, in my paintings, I was interested in more the space and the dimension and unusual perspectives, and I was less interested in the color.
Really?
And so it became clear to me that I was more interested in space, you know, than the color aspects of painting. I wasn't very good at painting.
Oh, well, maybe not. People say that to me about their early work. But when you did start doing sculptures and stuff, what kind of subjects were you interested in? Were you doing figures?
Well, I love the figure. Mm-hmm. And we were in school, in these classes, we were working from observation. And so we would work from models. And that's what got me interested. And I was interested in a Rodin-esque kind of tradition of working from observation with expression. I love clay. And I was interested in the anatomy and the whole history of sculpture, which had so much to do with the figure up until about the time that I was in school. Sculptors, as I say, had nothing to do with the figure. This was in the mid-70s.
People were being
and they were working
quite
in
innovative.
Very different directions.
Yeah, so you started with the figure. And what kind of concepts were you coming up with when you started taking yourself seriously as a sculptor?
Well, the figure started to abstract. And I was interested in a formalist approach and a simplified form. I was looking at early modern sculptors. I loved Henry Moore. And I was interested in fragmenting the figure and simplifying the form and also working with the geometry of the figure. And I think all of these threads can still be seen in aspects of my work. So that's where it began. And then as things progressed, the work would become more representational again, and then would go back towards abstraction and simplification, and I sort of go back and forth.
And when you started out, were you mainly doing stuff for yourself, or did you immediately start getting commissions?
The commissions came a bit later. It started with the colleges, a commission of Elizabeth Blackwell, one of our historic figures of the colleges.
That's really interesting. The first woman to get a degree in medicine.
Right.
And she went to school in Geneva.
She got her medical education in Geneva, and she was the one and only woman that's attended Hobart College.
Really? I didn't realize that.
That's right, because the women's college didn't exist at that time.
And so they asked you to do a representative figure of her. How did you do your research for that?
Well, I dug into the archive, and I was looking for photographs and writings of hers. And I mean, a lot has been written on her. She was a very important figure.
But you were depicting her physical self, so I was just wondering how you came up with what she...
Right. Well, there are some images that were helpful, except for the fact the images depict her later in life. And I didn't want to depict her later in life. I wanted to depict her about the age she would have been when she was attending the colleges, because I thought the students would be able to relate to that better. And also because she was at the forefront of something. So using age as a kind of a metaphor, I thought, was an interesting idea. And I was very lucky to find some photographs of her from the early 1840s.
Wow. That's
which
remarkable.
Was really a rare find.
Yeah.
So I had a sense of what she looked like then, and that was very lucky.
And how did you decide how to depict her? You have her sitting, don't you? I think I've seen it.
She is sitting, and that was a bit of a dilemma.
She has her hand on her chin,
right?
Right, yeah.
Right. Her hand to her face in a kind of a contemplative pose. That was taken from a drawing of her, also a depiction of her at a young age.
Uh-huh.
And so I used that gesture. But I had a problem, actually, when I was working for models. And in an armchair, to take that gesture, sort of drop the body down. I mean, if her elbow was on the arm of the chair, that she started to lean over. So I wound up turning the chair.
Uh-huh.
And her elbow was on the back of the chair. So in the sculpture, she is sitting, but she's sitting sideways in the chair. Now, that is kind of an unusual twist. And I look for these kinds of devices. That is a kind of a break from convention. And that was one of the statements that I was trying to make with the sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Because she was such an unusual...
Right.
She was
right.
A maverick.
An innovator, a pioneer.
Maverick, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when you're doing a piece just out of your imagination, how do you begin? Do you make drawings of some of the concepts that you come up with? Tell us how you go through the process.
Yeah. Concepts come from different places and sometimes in rather odd ways. I love going into antique shops and looking at stuff. And one concept that worked its way into my work is this hat form. And that's factored into a lot of pieces. And I originally discovered a little, you've probably seen these ashtrays that are like Mexican hats.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And I started studying this thing. And it was interesting to me. You know, I liked the top side of it. I liked the underside of it. And, of course, in art history, there is precedence for using hats and bowler hats. And so this became a kind of a motif in my work. I like the shape of it, and I like the meaning of it. It has lots of different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
And I like it as a representation of gender.
Uh-huh.
Because it is a male form and also a female form.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in my work, I like that reference.
So you go into an antique shop and you see some of these old-fashioned kinds of hats and so on, and then do you go home and draw them, or do you take photos? How do you begin that process?
Well, in that instance, I actually bought this little object for $2, and it sat on my shelf, and I studied it and just thought about it. But, of course, yeah, I'll do drawings and try things and configurations and... It's whatever. I mean, it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And then you start working with the clay, or do you work with wax? I'm not sure how sculptors actually end up with their bronzes nowadays. What kind of materials do
well,
you use?
Well, it's true you don't begin with the bronze.
Right.
It is a replacement process.
Uh-huh.
And so you get to bronze through a series of steps.
Uh-huh.
And, yes, clay is where it begins, and it goes through various other states, sometimes plaster, always wax if you're going to bronze casting.
Uh-huh.
So the sculptures begin in clay, and then they are through a series of molds. You know, it's two generations away by the time it's finished, and each state has to be reworked. So it's a long haul. There's a lot of process.
So you almost have to redo it during each
You
step.
Absolutely have to redo
wow.
it. Either you do it or someone does it for you, depending if you're having a foundry.
And if you decide you don't want to do that, what does it turn out? Like a ghost of what you had in mind, or... Just a,
you mean if you don't...
If you don't continue to change its shape during each process because it loses something.
Something is lost. And so for me, I do like to work it a lot in each state, even the metal. Even if I'm working with a commercial foundry, they will let me come in and work on the metal too. Because, you know, I like the pieces to regain what is lost in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. It is a shadow of itself if you don't put the life back into it at each successive step.
And do you have to learn that through experience, or does a sculptor, is that what one of the basics?
Well, I wasn't trained at school for that. I mean, yeah, that is something you learn.
Because I would not have thought of that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, and it's very different. I mean, how you work things in clay, how you work things in wax, and how you work things in metal.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. I happen to like working things in wax a lot.
Do you?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And sometimes you save things that don't work well in clay for another state. You don't want to save too much, if this makes any sense.
No, that does make sense. No.
Because, you don't want to do in metal what you could do in wax.
I see. So you have this little thought that you keep the shape of For a later day,
right. But, you know, these are refinements. I mean, you do it mostly in clay. Sometimes if the clay doesn't want to hold a form or a detail, you know, you save it for wax.
Well, you know, back to that hat concept, you seem to like to put things on people's heads because some of your sculptures have birds. What is the concept behind
that,
though? What are you thinking when you're putting things besides hats on people's heads?
Well, you know, with the birds, it had to do with this idea that statues in public.
Oh no!
You're going to get the birds, you know, one way or another. So, but I love that idea. So I started building them into the sculptures.
That's
with
remarkable.
A hope that there would be a bird on a bird on the head.
So you're not protecting your sculpture from the real birds.
No, I'm trying to attract them, actually, because I think it's fun. You know, it's a balance concept. One of the themes in my work has to do with balancing things. Mm-hmm. I sometimes do stacked forms. You know, I like the idea that a hat isn't really part of the body, but it's worn on the head. And then to put an apple or a bird on the hat, on the head, you know, you start to get the stacked forms. But sometimes I put the head in the hat.
Yeah.
So that, you know, rather than the hat on the head, I like inverting things also. These are sort of, I don't know, surrealist concepts.
Well, it's also whimsical, a lot of your stuff is. And what is that thing about opposites that you like to do? Well, what's that about?
Well, I like the idea of repetition. And so I came to some ideas where I was using the identical figure and pairing them, but not putting them in parallel poses. So I would, you know, you take the same figure and you invert it and you sort of reassemble it. You know, it looks almost like the figures are different, but as you observe it, you see they are the same.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they do look different. I've seen some of the photos of them.
Right.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be a mirror image, correct, in some ways?
They are, yeah. You know, it depends how you put them together. I mean, I have sometimes put them in parallel poses, and I've sometimes put them inverted, and sometimes just opposing and backwards and forwards, say.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know why I do it exactly. I can't always give a great explanation.
It just flies out of
you. Sometimes the titles reflect that as well.
Uh-huh. Your titles are interesting. You have titles like Brave New World and Bad Government. And
right. I've also used palindromes as titles.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And especially with the paired pieces.
Uh-huh. Explain what that means.
Well, palindromes are phrases that read the same backwards and forwards.
Mm-hmm.
So I will, for example, one of the first ones I used was Mata Mim Adam. And that was slightly disguised as a palindrome. It's probably the classic palindrome, Madam, I'm Adam.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I shifted some of the letters a little bit, or how I sort of broke up the phrase.
So
it looked like a foreign language.
Yeah, you're interested in language too, then.
Well, I like the idea of wordplay.
Mm-hmm.
And they sometimes clue at the pieces. But I mean, even if there's not an absolute association with what the title says, how the title reads, the fact that it's backwards and forwards and it's the same as you divide it in the middle, that reflects what's going on in the sculpture.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ted Aub. He's a sculptor and professor of art at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. I want to talk to you a little bit more about what I mentioned in the introduction, your most famous regional piece, the Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Please tell us how that came about. It was commissioned by Governor Pataki?
It was. This goes back to 1998, they had a big celebration in Seneca Falls, Celebrate 98, which was leading into the sesquicentennial of the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls. And there was going to be a summer celebration, and Hillary Clinton was invited to come, and then Governor Pataki was coming. And there was a sort of a grassroots effort to create a sculpture. They were just simply going to use that event to try to raise some money for it.
Mm.
But it turns out Governor Pataki funded it. So it went from sort of a concept to a reality very quickly, which was nice. It doesn't always happen.
Uh-huh. And did it start out as a concept of Amelia Bloomer introducing these two? Well, what was it supposed to be in the beginning?
That was pretty much given to me.
Okay.
The chance meeting on the street of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, introduced by Amelia Bloomer. That's a fact of history. Mm-hmm. And so that was the concept that I started with. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of a circle.
I know, it looks like they're dancing from some vantage points when you see that. It's on a bank in Seneca Falls for anybody who hasn't seen it.
Right. It does look like a dance.
It does.
It's lyrical. It's got rhythms, and that was important. And that was a little bit of the artistry, I suppose, coming into the work and trying to make something more than just a literal portrayal of an introduction. But, you know, I like the idea of a circle, but in fact the site doesn't have any depth. It's on the street.
Uh-huh.
And it took place on the street, although no one knows exactly where.
Ah. Uh-huh.
And so the circle became a little bit collapsed. But at a distance, it does look sort of rounded, and I like the idea of roundedness and continuity in the circle.
And you know what I thought when I first saw that? I thought, ooh, whoever made that is trying to let us celebrate how exciting it was for us for them to have met.
Right.
That was exactly what I thought when
I
first saw it.
You know, the energy is important, and movement.
Uh-huh.
Two of the figures are really quite active. Amelia Bloomer, who's making the introduction,
uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And Susan B. Anthony, who is moving towards Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who's being introduced, Susan B. Anthony is being introduced to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but she's the iconic figure of Seneca Falls.
Right, right.
And so, you know.
You know, I noticed none of the women are smiling in it. Was that a conscious decision? Or
it's funny, someone said that to me recently. How come they're not smiling?
Yeah.
The way I see it is I see them as serious. This was a really important meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have met eventually. I mean, I think they would have worked together. It wasn't a complete coincidence they met. It's just that's the moment they met, and that's what's being celebrated. And it is a moment of such importance that I guess they have serious expressions,
mm-hmm.
but I hope they're not frowning.
No. But I think sometimes when one does meet somebody who you think is going to be important in your life, you don't necessarily smile. You want to seem serious.
Right.
Yeah. Now I want to know this. Does your mindset change when you're doing your own work than when you're being asked to do a commission? Did you go at it in a different way?
Sure, it's a different.
Uh-huh.
It is a different process. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm interested in the works have different concerns. I mean, historic pieces are in the public domain, and I'm trying to respect the history, and you know, that's one kind of thing. I mean, I'm trying to do something interesting with it. I don't think all work out there that's historic is done in the most interesting ways these days.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying to be innovative in maybe subtle ways. The work that I do that isn't that is more independent work or gallery-type work, you'd almost think they were done by two completely different artists.
Indeed. I've noticed that.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah.
And I like them both. I mean, they're very different kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
and so they have a different look.
Mm-hmm.
They have things in common. For example, I mentioned liking things that are circular. That was an important statement in the Seneca Falls piece, continuity and circularity. Community. In my work, there are themes of circularity. In my independent work, that is. I mean, you know, a head and a hat and an apple together is all about circularity.
Uh-huh. So you're trying to connect.
So there are some commonalities.
Uh-huh. Did you have a personal philosophy about public art and what it should be? Do you worry about the town that it's going to be in and whether it respects the history or... How do you deal with that?
I do want to respect the history. I mean, it's not work. It's not independent work. There is a kind of an audience. It's a public audience,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's a responsibility involved because it's a depiction of history that is going to be left for a long time. And I do my research. I want to create a kind of likenesses of these people to a certain extent, although I don't think it's just about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are you in some ways trying to make history relevant to each generation that we'll probably see it perhaps 100 years hence?
Well, I'm certainly trying to make it relevant to people today.
Uh-huh.
I mean, who knows about the future? But an example of that was the Blackwell Commission on the campus. I mean, trying to give it an appeal to the current college students by making a youthful depiction
mm-hmm.
of someone. So I guess the answer is yes. I'm trying to find ways to make it interesting and relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I just have completed a piece, another piece for the campus of William Smith.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. He's the founder of the school.
Founder of William Smith College. We're celebrating our centennial year. And, you know, how to depict him in interesting ways.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I actually want to depict him as an elderly man.
I was going to ask
time.
You, what time period?
Right. Well, I'm showing him in his late 80s, because that's the age he was when he founded the college.
Mm-hmm.
That's very impressive.
That is.
Undertake an endeavor at that stage of life.
Mm-hmm.
And the college is on a hill. The women's college is on a hill. And I like that idea as a kind of a metaphor.
And he was a feminist. So it ties into Seneca Falls beautifully.
It does tie into Seneca Falls because they're the same cast of characters. His good friend in Geneva was Elizabeth Smith Miller, mm-hmm. who was, by the way, the first inventor and wearer of bloomers.
That's a funny piece.
And it was her friend, Amelia Bloomer, that popularized them in her newspaper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was the same time period and the same cast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you like being described as a postmodern surrealist? Does that box you in, or do you like having titles like that put on your name?
Well, I don't think it boxes me in. I don't mind.
Would you describe yourself that way, too?
I would. I mean, I think there are surrealist sort of aspects to my work, and yet I'm not a surrealist. I mean, that was a historic period that took place back when.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think there are, I guess I would describe postmodern elements in the work, and so I like the idea of that fusion to describe what I do. I do what I do, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it is definitely surrealist, but I was just wondering if you like the depiction. Now, how are you affected by reviews and sometimes negative reviews? Does that affect you as an artist?
Well, no one likes to read negative reviews, but, you know, I do what I do. I am who I am, and so I don't pay too much attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't gotten a lot of negative reviews.
Really? But what about the good reviews? How do they affect you?
Well, I like those a lot better.
but does it affect you as an artist, though?
Well, I must say, I don't think it really changes what I do. I mean, it's just what I do. It just comes out. I don't have a lot of control over it. I mean, I do.
Mm-hmm.
I try to shape the work. But it's interesting, even though the work changes, I mean, the same threads sort of run through the work.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can say nice things or they can say critical things. And it,
but I would think some artists would perhaps be swayed, going, oh, maybe I'm not pleasing people, so maybe I should change my whole attitude toward things. And that way it would be destructive.
Right. You know, if I were depending on art sales to make a living, that might change things. I mean, I'm in the fortunate position to have a great job at a wonderful college where most of my living comes from teaching. And
so it gives you a bit of freedom.
It gives me a lot of freedom,
uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, because it's not even like I'm showing all that much and I'm selling even less. I mean, it's nice with commissions because that helps.
Mm-hmm.
But even commissions, there's not a huge profit margin there because mm-hmm. these things are so expensive
yeah,
to produce
yeah.
these days.
Would you like to be a famous sculptor and being appearing in all kinds of museums? Is that what one strives for? Or are you happy with
the pace of... Well, you'd be foolish to strive for it. I mean, you can hope for it. Sure, that would be nice. I'd like to do more historic public commissions. It'd be great to have some things in Washington eventually, but however it turns out, I'm just,
yeah.
you know, I mean, these things, one tends to lead to another, but very slowly.
Yeah.
Very slowly.
Yeah. You have to live two lifetimes in order snatch it up, probably.
Right.
Well, then tell us about your teaching. You teach sculpture as well as design. How do you go about this? Is it mainly teaching technique or inspiration or...
The design that I teach is sort of the intro courses for the architecture sequence,
mm-hmm.
and which is involves sculpture, but isn't exclusively that. There's a difference, there's some subtle differences between sculpture and design. I think of design as creative problem solving, and involves, well, a lot of compromise, you know. And if you're solving a problem, you're given parameters and you have to sort of work your way through it, hopefully as creatively as possible. It is a very creative course, but always the assignments have a lot of parameters and restrictions. Sculpture is a little more freeform in its teaching. It depends on the level that I'm teaching. Intro courses are more structured than advanced courses. I do like teaching clay modeling, and when I do, that's a mid-level course. And when I do, we work from life. We'll do figures and portraits, and that's very traditional training. But hopefully in the advanced courses, they can take that and then open up and do more interesting technique. We do bronze casting, for example, in the advanced classes.
And can you spot talent? Can you tell when you think somebody's going to be incredibly successful?
You can, but they really have to work at it. I mean, if they've got the ability but aren't willing to really bring the discipline to it, it doesn't really go very far, very fast. What I really like is students that don't think they have the talent, but when they dig in and they develop it, if you can bring that out in students, that's very rewarding.
Is it the technique that you detect, or is it some kind of creativity coming from a masterful technique? How do you describe it?
I really don't like teaching technique. That's a necessary part of the process, but generally, you're teaching about ideas and developing concepts and trying to bring some sense of originality and creativity and expression out of the students and letting it come from within. And then you apply to that techniques that are necessary to develop the work. If I were teaching technique, it would be in say the design course, then it would become a shop course.
Ah, indeed.
And I would be a terrible shop teacher.
We only have about a minute left. Can you describe to us what you hope people take away from viewing your work?
Well, I hope it's work that people will spend time with looking at and over time, and that some of the ideas. And I think the pieces need to speak for themselves, and that the layers of thinking sort of unfold over time, but also that they just simply enjoy the work, you know, on a sort of a gut level. The whimsy in the work and the humor, I hope, is pleasing, but also the serious, sort of the undertones in the work. That too. It's perhaps an unusual blend of things that comes through the work. And whatever that is, whatever people take from it is fine. I hope they get something from it.
Well, Ted Aub, I'm sure they do. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.